This is a.
One thing in the
notebook that was left at our
recording
field trip, and I'm not sure if it's somebody from.
Hello.
Something.
It's recording.
Okay. I'm not sure where our committee members are today, but I'm sure that they're...
The important ones are here, Madam Chair.
There are... our deadlines are approaching, and bills are being heard fast and furiously, so I'm hoping that some of them are doing important work and will be joining us shortly. We do want to get started, though, and today we will begin by talking about conservation and energy efficiency and just getting an idea of what's being done currently. So I'd like to begin with Wayne Shirley from the Regulatory Assistance Project.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Dibble.
I just wanted to give Wayne Shirley a brief introduction if I could. Wayne Shirley is here from out of town, and he's going to talk a little bit about the concept of decoupling, which is a rate making proposal that's contained in the proposals that have come forward on energy conservation and efficiency from the governor's office, as well as my own bill. And it's I wish more members were here. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to bring his materials around to them. This is going to be an important part of the concept, which really helps keep this bill together. It helps decouple, literally, the notion of saving energy from the amount that it gets sold.
Well, I've heard this term around much during the session, and lots of speculation about how you do it and if you can do it. So I'm eager to hear what you have to say.
Maybe if you speak slowly, then people will trickle in.
Okay, Mr. Shirley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me to speak today. As was noted, I'm here to address the regulatory policy known as decoupling. And I'll try to be concise, but I also intend to provide a fair degree of detail because I believe it's important for your understanding of this topic. I'm happy to answer questions at any time or at the end of my comments. My name is Wayne Shirley. I'm a director of the Regulatory Assistance Project, or more commonly known as RAP. RAP is a nonprofit organization formed in 1992 by former utility regulators that provides research, analysis, and educational assistance to public officials on primarily electric utility regulation, although we do occasionally venture into the gas industry as well. Each of us is a former utility regulator. My personal experience includes serving as general counsel for a utility commission in New Mexico, serving as New Mexico's public ratepayer advocate, serving as counsel for the New Mexico Industrial Energy Consumers, and finally, I was chair of the New Mexico Public Utilities Commission. I'm here to provide insights into a form of utility regulation referred to as decoupling, but before we get into the details, I think it's useful to review traditional regulation of public utilities, both so we can compare decoupling to that, but also because it demonstrates the problem that decoupling is intended to solve. I am more familiar with the electric industry, and my remarks will use the electric industry as references, but largely the issues are transferable between the gas and electric industry, although the motivations that the utilities have may be slightly different, and I'll try to touch on that as well. For most of the 20th century, public utilities in this country were regulated under a system that's traditionally called the cost-of-service method. Under this method, the utilities would file a rate case with the commission. The rate case information would be based upon the financial records of that utility for a 12-month period. It's usually a calendar year, but it doesn't have to be. And that period is referred to as the test year. The idea of a rate case under cost of service rate making is to assure that all the costs incurred serving the customers, including the return on capital and the return of that capital, would be recovered through the rates paid by consumers. Typically, in a rate case, you add up all of those expenses, you allocate those expenses between the various rate classes based upon how much they use the system, usually based upon the sales to that rate class. And then at the end, you divide that so-called revenue requirement by the sales units, the units sold to each class, to come up with the price. And the price is the ultimate end product of a rate case. And in that process, obviously, part of that is a calculation of a fair rate of return to the utility, and that's included in these costs that are added together for the rate case. But once the rate case is done and the prices have been set, the rate case really has very little to do with what happens after that, other than that the prices have been set. As you go forward in time, the sales that actually occur to customers will most certainly be different than what was assumed in the rate case. It may be higher or it may be lower. In the case where it's higher, it also means the utility's profits are higher. And if sales are less, the utility's profits are less. Fairly straightforward concept, common to every industry in the country. The distinguishing factor for public utilities, however, is that there are numerous public policy objectives associated with utility service that run counter to the notion of more sales are better, most notably energy efficiency, which is a much cheaper way to provide service than the provision of new supply-side resources. So we have this dilemma where the utilities, obviously management working for shareholders, want to increase profits, and their primary method for doing that is increasing sales. Now, they could try to reduce expenses, but in the utility industry, most of the expenses of the utility are fixed, at least in the short run, between rate cases. So it's very difficult to increase your profits by decreasing your expenses. Expenses track actually more closely with the number of customers you have between rate cases than they do with the sales volume those customers buy from the utility. This conflict between increasing sales for greater profits versus public policy objectives of greater efficiency is what we collectively call the throughput issue or the throughput problem. And decoupling is the solution to that dilemma. What decoupling attempts to do is to make the utility's revenues insensitive to the volume of consumption by the consumers. For many, this is a rather counterintuitive notion, but I hope when I'm done here, you'll agree that this is the right approach to solve this problem. I also want to note that the basket of expenses that we're talking about that are affected by this problem are the delivery costs of the system primarily, or the fixed cost of the system. This doesn't include the commodity. So in the case of natural gas, for example, the actual volume of gas purchased by the system is treated differently. That's a pass-through. The customers pay what the company paid to buy that gas in a marketplace. In the case of an electric utility, the fixed costs include the investment in power plants, but not the fuel cost incurred to generate the energy. So we're really talking about just the portion of the financial activity in the company that's related to its profits. The things that are passed through would continue to be passed through as a commodity item and are really outside the scope of this. There has emerged in the past, I would say, 5 years or so, the predominant method of decoupling is now something called the revenue per customer decoupling method. And this method begins with a traditional rate case, just like we've always done. And at the end of that rate case, one additional calculation is made beyond the setting of the price, and that is a computation of what the average revenues are for each class per customer for any given period. I'm going to use a monthly mechanism here because I think that's the best way to do this, although decoupling adjustments could be done quarterly or annually. But let's just use a monthly example. So the calculation is made. This revenue per customer value then becomes the target or reference value that you use going forward to determine how much revenues the company is allowed to collect. In any future period, all you need to do is find out the number of customers on the system, and you can multiply it by this target revenue per customer value, and that gives you this adjusted revenue requirement that the company is then allowed to collect. Now, because we've now tied revenues to the number of customers rather than to the volume of sales, the revenues remain relatively constant and will trend up or down only by the number of customers being added or subtracted on the system. I want to say that this is a revenue design method, and it's not a rate design or a pricing design method. And the important thing to understand here is that you continue to charge customers with traditional prices. That is, take a small commercial customer on the electric system would typically pay a customer charge of some amount and then a demand charge and an energy charge based upon the metering of their own consumption. That continues to stay in place. So for any individual customer, if they use more electricity, they'll pay more. If they use less electricity, they'll pay less. This is an important factor in decoupling because you want to maintain the ability for the customer to save money by deploying energy efficiency. And if you can decouple by just raising prices on the fixed charges and ignoring the volumetric rates. But if you do that, then the customer is no longer sensitive to their impacts on the system in terms of the costs they cause. They don't recognize that it costs more to use more. So it's important to maintain this long-run marginal cost effect of using volumetric pricing for customers. So that's the basic revenue per customer decoupling method. I hope I didn't get too far down in the weeds in describing it. There are some collateral issues I want to talk about relative to decoupling, one of which is an associated issue related.
Excuse me, Mr. Shirley, we're going to ask you a question.
Sure.
Pull your microphone.
Madam Chair, Mr. Shirley, we're all pretty uninitiated, so okay. What is the different charge that happens, and if every what is the decoupling that keeps the revenue stable then for the utility if each customer's use bill reflects their use? So what is the mechanism then that holds the revenue steady?
I'm sorry, I should explain that, Madam Chairman, Senator. As you move through time, and you now know the number of customers, you can multiply this times that target revenue number I talked about. This gives you the allowed revenues. You then compare that to the actual revenues that would be collected from those prices that were set in that last rate case. And that difference has to be either refunded to customers or collected, depending on whether it's a negative or a positive number. And in order to do that, you take that difference and you divide it by the current consumption levels or billing determinants. And that becomes an adjustment to the price. So what happens is the price will float up and down slightly as you move through time to maintain this target revenue value, even though the underlying consumption by the customers may be going up or may be going down. If, in fact, overall, the consumption is going down. Let's say you've had a really successful energy efficiency program and you've shaved off 1% of the sales for that utility. That 1% of sales will then be recovered by raising the price to all the customers and spreading the effect across everyone. And so the price goes up slightly in that scenario. Conversely, if consumption's gone up, the opposite will happen, and the prices will go down slightly.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Mr. Shirley, I'm not a senator.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So let's just give you an example. So there's 100 customers in whatever, they're in a class, and their rates have been set based on some expected consumption, and they're all real conservers, or it's a warm winter. Let's say it's a warm winter, and so their use goes down. What shows up on their bill that brings the utility back up to what their benchmark or whatever it is? Is there a monthly bill adjustment? Or,
yes.
And how is that calculated again?
Mr. Shirley.
Madam Chairman, in your case where you've got 100 customers, let's assume that one customer reduces consumption. And let's assume every customer, on average, was using 100 kilowatt hours a month. And that one customer cuts their consumption in half, so now it's down to 50 kilowatt hours a month. The total for the class is 100 times the original 100 kilowatt hours per month, which is 10,000, less the 50 that's now been saved. So now you've got 9,950 kilowatt hours of sales that you have to recover all of your costs from. So you will adjust the price so that the total revenues equal an average for the class of whatever your target revenue was for that class. Did you follow that?
So, Mr. Shirley, are you saying that everybody in the rate class will benefit from the conservation of the one party?
No.
Okay.
In fact, what happens is the revenue loss from this one customer that has saved energy is recouped from everyone. This is exactly what would happen if you had a new rate case at that point. But this is a mechanism that does this monthly rather than waiting for the next big rate case to make that calculation.
So you're saying that everybody's costs will go up for the
slightly.
Next month.
That's correct.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
But it's also important to note that the customer who saved a bunch of energy, who didn't use as much energy, though they won't save as much money as they would have under the previous system, they will still have saved quite a bit of money. I mean, they're not going to have to pay as much as they would have had they not saved all of that.
No. They will save some money, but everybody else will be paying more.
Correct.
That's correct. And I think it's important to remember that decoupling is a mechanism that is intended to address a profit issue for the utility,
okay.
Not to create incentives for energy efficiency.
Okay.
But it should be coupled with an aggressive energy efficiency program. That's why you want to do decoupling, is so you can enable energy efficiency to happen, which benefits everyone in the long run.
Well, the utility company's been subsidizing other programs for a long time, so now we're going to start subsidizing them.
No. Well, actually, there's no subsidy here because the total revenue collection is not greater than what would have been allowed in a rate case.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shirley, now say we come to a rate case then, and we need that adjustment upward. All the classes are treated, though, differently, and I'm assuming. And so if you're showing that there's been a decrease overall in the usage, how do you determine what the increase should be based on the rate or the classes?
Right.
Decoupling, Mr. Shirley.
Madam Chairman, Senator, the decoupling mechanism is done separately for each rate class. And so these shifts in revenues are contained within a class. Now, when you get to a next big rate case, one of the steps in a rate case is allocating the total revenue requirement amongst the different classes. And if a single class has decreased its share of the total usage on the system, at that point, the whole class will experience a reduced allocation revenue requirement in that rate case. But between rate cases, the target revenues that are calculated in the decoupling method are referenced to the last rate case when that allocation was made. Does that address your question?
Somewhat.
Senator Dahl?
So that answers it pretty well. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Anderson?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that might have been an answer to my question, but let me make sure, because I was going to ask what happens. You asked, Mr. Fuller asked, what if one person conserves? What if everyone in the whole class conserves? And what you're saying, what you just said is, if the whole class conserves, I mean, this is all theoretical, obviously, then overall they would have a reduction? That class would get a reduction in a rate case?
Well,
I'm not following how that would
work. Mr. Shirley.
Madam Chairman, Senator, and the decoupling mechanism I'm describing occurs between rate cases. So when you have a rate case, you do this allocation among the classes based on their contribution, usually to the system peak or some other formula. And so that class responsibility for revenue requirement is sort of frozen at that point until the next rate case. If an entire class is reduced its consumption relative to the whole company, and when you get to the next rate case, they will be allocated less revenue requirement than they would have been had they not reduced their consumption.
So,
okay.
Senator Anderson.
Well, let me make sure, maybe this has already been asked too, but just to make sure I understand it. So those who reduce will, their extra rates that they would have paid or their extra costs that they would have paid is shared by the other remaining members. But Senator Dibble said there's still a reduction. So you get a reduction if you conserve. So you still have some incentive to conserve, but you don't get as much of a reduction. Is that right?
My understanding is, say the person, one out of 10 people cut their
consumption.
Their consumption by half. So they're at 50 and everybody else is at 100. Then the next bill, the 50, would be spread among all 10 members and they would all share in the cost recovery. Is that correct?
That missing 50.
That missing 50.
But then, Madam Chair, if I may, I mean,
Senator Anderson.
If you start to get to where, say, half the class conserves and you spread it among the other members, does the proportion change? I mean, or is it just whatever? I mean, if 9 out of 10 conserve, then the one pays?
No,
rest?
All 10 pay, but I don't know if Mr. Shirley can explain this differently. If you're at 100 and you've cut it in half, you still pay your 50 plus whatever the 50 is that's apportioned over the 10 different ratepayers. So that you're still up a portion. You don't save the full half.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make it clear?
Madam Chair, yeah. May I?
Mr. Shirley.
Senator, let's try to step back a little bit here. Let's say you need to collect $100 from the class.
Mm-hmm.
That $100 is going to be collected whether you've consumed 1,000 kilowatt hours or 100 kilowatt hours. So all you're really doing is determining that you need to collect the $100 and then computing a price based on current consumption levels that'll deliver that $100. Now, within that consumption, some customers may have reduced their usage, others may have increased their usage, and their bills will go up and down accordingly, but the price that they all pay will be based upon this revenue that needs to be collected in that period for that class.
So, Madam Chair, so the individual
Senator Anderson.
Who conserved will pay the same amount they were paying before.
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
No, Mr. Shirley.
This is a common misconception about decoupling. Let's take that one customer that conserved, and whereas we were collecting $100, $10 from 10 different customers in a class, and now one customer is only contributing 5 because they cut their consumption in half. They will... That $5 that has to be now recovered from somewhere is spread over all 10 customers. So in this example, that customer would pay $9.50. They'll save the 50 cents, but they do have a slight price increase that they share with everyone else. Okay. Now, I want to say that when you get into the big numbers of real rate classes, the incremental changes that you see from efficiency are not very large compared to the total consumption on the system. And in my example, I was talking about something that was 5% of the total consumption. In reality, what you're likely to see in a monthly sort of calculation is something more on the order of a quarter of a percent or something smaller. So these are very small deltas that drive these price changes month to month.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Dipple.
It's important to keep in mind that, to that point he just made, what we're going for, of course, is a cumulative savings over a long period of time. And the argument or the kind of the theoretical underpinning of decoupling is that the kind of savings that we see in consumption by consumers wouldn't occur absent an aggressive conservation program that's in place. So, you know, that the decoupling allows the utilities to feel comfortable pursuing. So the savings that a customer experiences, while not maybe as great as if they had done it under the previous regime, they probably wouldn't have experienced anyways, because the utility wouldn't be pursuing such an aggressive conservation program. It's kind of a but-for test.
Madam Chair. Hi, Senator Rosen.
So do I understand this correctly, that the one person that was conserving is going to be penalized, basically, because it's going to be spread out?
Not really. That person will.
It's perceived, though. I mean, they are going to be sharing in that 50% that they did save.
Okay. Mr. Fuller wants to take a stab at this.
I'll bounce it off, Mr. Shirley, Madam Chair. I think the two things to keep in mind is there's a price for what you use, and there's how much you use. So if you use less, when you apply that use against the rate, that'll give you what you pay. And the rate will have to be increased if you use less, because you want to get $1,000. And so you get that by putting a rate against use. And if your use is going to go down, then that rate will have to go up. The price, as he called it, will have to go up. So if you as an individual consumer use less, well, the unit, your usage will be applied against that rate, and you'll have some savings there because you have used less. But the rate for what you use will go up, the price, to reach that benchmark revenue for that class. So if you keep, those are the two distinctions. I think get a little confusing. Is that, am I right, Mr. Shirley?
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, that's exactly right. Let me just also note that separate from this, in the gas side, the cost of the gas itself is a savings that the customer keeps completely. There is no reallocation of cost there because that's a pass-through item. And on the electric side, the fuel and purchase power adjustment clause, if you will, that the customer pays is also a dollar-for-dollar savings for that customer. So in terms of the commodity, that more efficient customer captures all of the savings. In the case of these delivery charges, the fixed costs of the system, that customer does pick up a slight increase in price that slightly dilutes their savings, but it's not a very big dilution. And that savings rate maintains itself for quite some period of time.
Okay, we still have a few questions. So, Senator Dibble.
Take another stab at it to respond directly to Senator Rosen. While your statement is literally true, yes, someone saves a certain amount of money, but they don't save that exact or a certain amount of power. They don't use as much power, but they don't save the corresponding equivalent amount of money. You know, what the price they pay comes back a little bit to deliver to the utility what they're expecting to get. However, it can be argued that that customer would not have even saved this amount of energy because they wouldn't have come in contact with the conservation program that the utility was engaged in. So maybe they didn't know about energy-efficient light bulbs before the utility company came to their house and said, hey, you should use energy-efficient light bulbs. And so they put them in, saved all this money that they wouldn't have otherwise. And granted, they're going to come back a little bit to pay a little bit more, you know, less than that savings. But, you know, but for the conservation program, they would not have saved that energy.
Okay. Senator Dahl and then Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I on this point, last year there was a rate case that I know that was just like this. One of the reasons for it, the need for an increase was because consumers were saving, reducing their use of energy. So as they conserved, they come forward and say that we need to make more money on this. So it appears as though we're being penalized for conserving. But that only will happen at the point of the rate case then. In between time, as Senator Dibble saying, individuals who conserve are saving money on their bills at that time, but then it gets readjusted at the point we get to the rate case to make up for the difference that they didn't make. So I don't know if that clears it up a little bit, but it does appear as though it's a penalty for conserving.
Senator Anderson.
Well, and Madam Chair, I think the whole thing fits together with some stronger requirements of the utilities to conserve. So if we're going to tell them they have to aggressively conserve a lot more, this matches up with that. And so it's a fair kind of trade-off. If we require them to conserve more, we're going to take away their disincentive to do that. And in exchange for them getting this incentive to be held harmless, it's only fair to do that if we're expecting them to conserve dramatically more. And I think that's what we're talking about, that those two things go together, and that's the context in which we're considering this, I believe.
Okay. Senator Cope.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I might have missed this. My apologies for coming in a little late. How many states currently decouple electric sales from profits? Any idea?
Mr. Shirley.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have an exact count. I think it's I would say four or five at this point. That number is growing. The number of states with gas decoupling is larger. And there's reasons why we see it more on the gas side than the electric, and it has to do with the underlying usage trends for those two industries. In the gas industry, usage per customer is declining due primarily to greater efficiencies in in-use appliances, and to some extent, recent weather trends, although that's a variable that can go either direction. So gas companies see a deterioration in profits between rate cases because of this declining sales phenomenon. So they're much more interested in decoupling right now than the electric sector, which tends to see increasing sales per customer over time. And in effect, they're garnering windfalls as their profits rise between rate cases above their allowed rate of return. So they're not as interested in this. The effect of decoupling is really to sort of have a mini rate case every month that trues up the cost of service to the revenues being collected from the customers. Instead of waiting to have the rate case that was mentioned before, where you get a big change in rates, this has an incremental effect moving through time that tracks more closely with what's really going on with the underlying customer usage.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shirley, I'm not sure where we interrupted you in your presentation.
I want to talk about another issue that is a common misperception about decoupling, and it has to do with weather and the so-called weather risk. In traditional regulation, if you have a very cold winter, sales go up and the utility's profits go up. If you have a very mild winter, the opposite happens. Sales go down, profits go down. And if you decouple and you use the method I've described here and you don't make any other adjustments to that calculation, you will also remove this weather risk from the utility so that no longer will the profits rise and fall with extreme weather or mild weather. And there's a common misperception that if you remove this weather risk from the utility that you must therefore shift it to the customers. But in fact, the reality is that the customers and the utility share that weather risk they have it together or they can avoid it together. Obviously, when those sales go up in those cold winters, it's the customers that are paying those additional revenues. So they're clearly taking the risk with the utility. And if you use the sort of straightforward vanilla revenue per customer decoupling method, you'll eliminate that risk. And I think there's good reasons to eliminate that risk, and I've been hard-pressed to find any good reason to impose that risk on the utility and the customers. One of the good reasons to do it is that variability in earnings translates into a higher cost of capital for the utility. And it's not insignificant money. For a moderately sized utility, it could be $5 to $10 million a year in revenue requirements. And unlike many trade-offs in this area, which are, you know, trade-offs between utilities and customers, this is a case where the utilities can avoid the higher cost of capital by avoiding this variability from weather, and that translates into a savings for the consumers. There are techniques to do this in a way that prevents hurting the shareholders. You can change the capital structure and put more debt into it, basically, so that the customers capture the value of the decrease in the cost of capital, but the shareholders don't suffer a reduced return on equity. I think it's an important issue to be aware of, and hopefully you'll see fit to let that weather risk go away and not have the customers and the utility be exposed to that risk. One other note about the weather risk is it really, if you have that weather risk, it's not a very low-income friendly policy, because what you do is you increase bills further in the severe weather seasons at the point in time when bills are already high and those customers may be struggling to pay bills. And it's just, I think, a more humane policy to remove the weather risk and mitigate that effect. And remember, this is only on the fixed cost part of the system. It's not the commodity. Those customers still see that variation in both volume and price for the commodity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Does this system work if you have a bunch of your customers on that, like a budget helper plan? Because then you kind of lose your flexibility. So,
well, Madam Chair, Senator, when you say budget helper, I'm not quite sure what you mean. I'm familiar with plans that allow customers to pay an average bill, but it's still based on their real consumption. It may be recalculated every 12 months. Mm-hmm. So you set a new average payment. In that case, the consumption is still the basis for what that customer pays. The cash flow is different because the customer pays the same month, same amount every month. But the effect of savings is still there. If the customer reduces consumption, then this average payment they make will go down going forward. And it really, this is unaffected by decoupling. It's not really, decoupling doesn't affect it, and that doesn't affect decoupling.
So, Mr. Shirley, does this, if you take into account weather, though, and those variables, does this, in effect, put all of us on type of an averaging type of plan?
Not really, because you continue to pay prices that are volumetrically based. So you have a kilowatt-hour charge or a therm charge in the gas industry, and that's what your bill is a function of. It's the total average value for the class that drives the computation. And so you want to collect that amount of revenue, but you collect it through a price that's volume-based. So if you reduce consumption, you save money. If you increase consumption, you pay more.
How complex is it to change over to a system of decoupling?
This is actually, in my view, a fairly simple extension of traditional regulation. I think a lot of people think it's very complex, and it sounds sort of complex when we're sitting here trying to talk about it verbally, but the algebra is fairly straightforward, and it uses existing information that we already generate in the rate case environment. It extends it slightly with one additional computation, this average revenue per customer value, and then it adjusts prices periodically, I recommend monthly, just like we do with fuel clauses and purchase gas adjustment clauses. So every month you've got information that comes in. It's not subject to litigation. You know, it's not a judgment call. These are numbers that come right off the billing information, the meter reading information for that utility. And it's just run through the formula, and it generates this small change in price that's then applied to those bills. So it's really a fairly straightforward, low-maintenance kind of activity. No more effort than you see with a fuel clause or a purchase a gas adjustment clause. Okay. I do, if I could, I was asked to address the question of how much legislation should be prescriptive to the commission versus leaving things to their discretion. And I know this is a common problem with legislation and regulatory agencies.
I think this is my request, Madam Chair, and it's to the PUC, and you know, should we tell the PUC exactly all the parameters that we would like the a pilot undertaken, or should we let the PUC figure it out? You know, it's kind of something that comes up a lot in this committee. So,
okay,
we have a former public utilities commissioner here,
Mr. Shirley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am sort of wearing my head as a former utility commissioner with this, but I think it's really important for the legislation to make absolutely clear to the commission that the intent here is to decouple profits from revenues and leave no doubt that that's what you're expecting the commission to do. I think it's troublesome, though, to go beyond that with very much detail because these calculations really are embedded in the existing regulatory framework, and it's part of what they already know how to do. These are the kind of calculations they're familiar with. And I think it's context sensitive in the sense that the individual utilities and the customer constituents for those utilities, the regular stakeholders that show up in rate cases and argue their positions, are well able, in my view, to wrestle with these issues and to come to some terms with the commission on how to do it. I wouldn't be too worried about those details. I think you might also, though, want some regular reporting on how it's going, how it works, you know, what the price impacts were, and so forth, so that you are aware of the impact of this change. But I wouldn't be too concerned about the mechanics because I think the commission, they've got the expertise and they know really how to do this. It's not a matter of reinventing the entire wheel of regulation.
Okay.
Finally, I just wanted to make a comment that this sits in the context, as we've said, of more aggressive energy efficiency policies and so forth. And I think we have to think about this as a challenge to us all to redefine the business model for public utilities. Right now, their business model is increased profits by increasing sales. This is a model that runs directly counter to these public policy objectives that I think we all share. And it also runs counter to what they know, which is that it increases long-run costs to increase sales. And so this is just a piece of that puzzle, but it's probably the most important piece in terms of the threshold, because unless you remove this disincentive from the utilities, the profit impacts of good energy efficiency deployment will be quite drastic on them, and they will fight hard to keep it from happening. And if it does happen, they'll be back before the commission more regularly for full-scale, full-blown litigated rate cases, which just add to it the expenses of providing service. So it's different than what we've traditionally done, but I think it's part of the step forward to redefine that business model for the public utilities. And
okay.
With that, I think I'm done. I'll be glad to answer any other questions.
Okay. what are the utility companies' response to this type of a process usually?
Well, as I said earlier, the gas utilities have embraced it. The electric utilities are more reluctant to embrace it. I think looking forward, now that it seems quite apparent we're going to have some sort of carbon regulation in the near future, I think the electric industry is going to have to come to grips with a more aggressive energy efficiency policy, because energy efficiency will be the cheapest way to reduce carbon going forward. There's no doubt about that. All other options are much more expensive in terms of addressing carbon responsibilities. And at some point, the electric utilities are going to have to come to grips with that. And when they do, they're going to have to look to decoupling, because they can't implement energy efficiency and suffer the profit impacts from that unless they've decoupled. Right now, they enjoy these windfalls between rate cases because of their increase in sales. But at some point, I think the carbon risk that they face is going to become so great that they're going to have to do it. And I would recommend that you apply this to both gas and electric immediately. I understand the electric utilities will push back, and they'll push back hard, because right now they enjoy the regulatory lag, as we call it, between rate cases. But it's not a long-run sustainable position on their part. And I think it's time to come to the table and make that happen.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Shirley.
Thank you.
Next, I'll call Deputy Commissioner Ed Garvey and Christy Bresvin.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. With me is Christy Bresvin, who is the Energy Conservation Coordinator who works for me, and she's been in charge of the SIP program, which I'm about to give a quick overview, and she'll handle all your hard questions. Before I go into my actual formal presentation, I wanted to give you a quick sort of summary of how good a program, the Energy Conservation Program, the SIP program that the state of Minnesota has, that we're sort of talking about here. And what I'm sort of handing out to you is a audit of the program by the Office of Legislative Auditors of a couple of years ago that confirms, and it's number one's finding, is that the benefits of the Conservation Improvement Program are greater than its costs, and the program has potential to provide cost-effective energy conservation in the future. I mean, this program has provided a lot of savings, and I'll provide a chart explaining that. The second handout is the scorecard offered by the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy, the ACEEE. And the important part of my – this is a sort of a pretty quick program, but the best way to look at it is to flip it over to page 18 and look at the last page. And it sort of shows that Minnesota is fourth in the nation using O3 savings in cumulative annual kilowatt-hour savings as a percentage of kilowatt-hour sales. I mean, it sort of shows that not only do we have a good program, but we're very, very good as compared to the rest of the country. Let me quickly walk through the energy efficiency program operated by the Department of Commerce on behalf of the legislature. The first question is sort of the background. The electric utilities, by statute, has to spend a specific amount of their gross operating revenues. 1.5% of gross operating revenues for most electrics. XL Energy is special, and they get 2% of their gross operating revenues. Gas utilities have a minimum spending of 0.5% of their gross operating revenues. The Conservation Improvement Program serves a wide range of customer classes. You just heard a quick conversation about that, about the classes and the significance of those classes. The utility's obligation is not only to save energy, but to save energy in a cost-effective way, in the sense that every dollar spent must save at least a dollar of energy and energy costs. And you'll see data that shows that not only do we meet that dollar for dollar, but we exceed it significantly in most cases. The statute also provides targeting programs for low-income customers. And we'll come back to that issue because it's a very important issue that we want to always pay attention to. This is a quick sort of pie chart of expenditures. I round up to in 05 dollars about $100 million our utilities spend. Our utilities spend it. We oversee their spending. It is not our money. It is their money. We just make sure that they're spending it thoughtfully and wisely and according to a plan that we review. Half of that is the IOUs, the investor-owned. That's the blue part of the pie. The green is the co-ops. This one is green. On there, it's the bright yellow. It's $22 million. Muni Electrics are $10.7 million. Muni, and then gas is the balance at about $16 million. So the electric is far and away the bulk of the funds. So about $85 million are spent by our electrics on SIP, with $15, $16 million devoted to our gas.
Madam Chair.
This slide gives you a quick breakdown.
Deputy Commissioner.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Dibble has a question.
Thanks. I just had a clarification question. The $100 million that's spent, that's not money that's just taken off the top. That's money that is rolled that is added to the rates that customers pay. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman,
Deputy
members of the committee, Senator Dibble, correct. These are ratepayer-collected fees, and you see them on your bills.
Great. Thank you.
This chart, Madam Chair, members of the committee, shows the breakdown of that pie chart that I showed you by company. You see XL Energy Electric at $42 million, far and away the biggest, especially when you bring in their gas part was at 4.6. So XL gas at roughly 4.7 million, $47 million is roughly half of the total SIP expenditures. And you sort of see the breakdown thereby by that chart. Cost recovery. Senator Dibble just brought this up. IOUs are allowed to recover prudent investments and expenditures for SIP on their bills. Cost recovery is authorized by Minnesota statute. The municipal and cooperative utilities are not rate regulated, so that they collect the SIP costs pursuant to their fee structures as overseen by their governing boards. There is a way that that we try to encourage the utilities to do as good a job as they can. The decoupling discussion that you just heard with from Mr. Shirley is one way. It's a more direct and clean way. This is the way we do it now since we don't have the decoupling. It is that the IOUs, and it's only applicable to IOUs, of course, are eligible to receive a financial incentive, an extra amount or a SPIF, as I like to sort of talk, up to 30% of the amount of SIP spending or their approved budget, whichever is less, if they meet and exceed the energy savings goal that we establish with them in their SIP plan that is approved by me as delegated by the Commissioner of Commerce. It's a incentive based on a percentage of their actual net benefits. We do sort of calculate that, and that SIP incentive program is authorized by statute, so we are implementing that. This is the complicated formula that we go through. It's complicated. It's detailed. The utilities understand it. My staff understand it. I ask them the questions, and they give me the answers. So if you have a question on this slide, wait and hold off so Christy can answer that question. This, Madam Chair, members of the committee, sort of shows the historic savings that the utilities have accomplished over the last 5 to 6 years. We think that this is important to show because it sort of shows that there have been real savings. Those savings vary by year for individual utilities and vary by year for the sectors. It also is very different that there's a very different savings percentage between gas and electric. This chart shows, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the first line, the dotted line on the top is what we would call a SIP-less world. What the growth would be without SIP in the electric setting. The blue line is the current SIP savings. And the line underneath it is what we think the savings would, what the growth in electrical consumption would be, this is for electricity, would be if you adopted a 1.5% savings. Madam Chairman, this is the same chart for gas consumption. This is more or less the same set of data shown in bar chart form by various companies. The company on the left is Xcel Electric, then Minnesota Power, Otter Tail, IPL, and then all electrics on the far right. And once again,
Madam Chair, can we get this in a hard copy?
Is that possible?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Send us a paper copy of this?
Yes, Madam Chair. We made changes to it in preparation for this that we're not ready to give them out right now, but we can do that by sort of close of the hearing.
Okay, thank you.
This is the same chart for gas. The other issues that we have to pay attention to, that the committee needs to pay attention to as we're thinking about it, is that, again, the low-income gas and electric programs, how to make sure that part of our citizenry receives the benefits of this. Research, development, and evaluation, how do we evaluate the savings? How do we evaluate the benefits? How do we basically encourage even more advances in energy savings? The movement towards ENERGY STAR buildings and sustainable guidelines and benchmarking. Those aren't directly related to the SIP programs, but they certainly have huge impacts on energy use. Low-income programs. Right now, we spend about $4.7 million out of our SIP in 2006 on low-income programs. We use a 3-year historic average as the floor. This is a problem. One of the things that the legislative auditor has urged us to do, and we are seeking legislative change of that, is to change that. Utilities work with us, but they work directly, mostly with local service providers, your local community action programs to provide most of these services, as well as a series of very, very effective and useful nonprofits. Research and development. The law allows 10% of each utility's SIP expenditures to be devoted towards R&D, and it caps evaluation at 3%. Currently, that cap would be $13 million. On average, a 5-year rolling average, the utilities have only spent $3.6 million. Those efforts are done on an individual utility-by-utility basis, based upon whatever their plan is that they file with us that we approve. This chart shows the number of ENERGY STAR buildings that we have. We have a set as a goal by the governor to increase that from the current 89 to 1,000. We think that's a worthy thing, but you sort of see the list where offices and supermarkets and schools are the number one recipients, but there's plenty of other buildings in the state that can become ENERGY STAR. The state of Minnesota, Department of Commerce, working with the Department of Administration, is working to provide sustainable building guidelines, not only for all state buildings, but also for any other building that's being constructed in the state. These are buildings that we want to set up to lead by example, as well as provide assistance and guidelines for new construction. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that concludes my quick presentation overview of the SIP program. These is a list of the resources. As the committee knows, I am working with all the stakeholders, many of whom are in the room, led by you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble, to work through how to make some improvements to our energy conservation program, take the program that we have now with the SIP program that is very, very good, and get the big gains. And I'm very, very pleased to be able to work with your leadership, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble, and all the stakeholders, because I think we are making some progress under particularly Senator Dibble's guidance.
Deputy Commissioner Garvey, what is your estimate? Do you think there's enough conservation that could be done that it could eliminate the need for any further baseload plants?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, is that a question I can defer to Christy, who should answer all the hard questions?
I would like opinions from people about the potential for that.
What was the question, Madam Chair?
The question is it possible to conserve enough and to be able to eliminate the need for any further baseload plants?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, you know, that's a question that actually we struggle with a lot. The answer is is probably not. That energy conservation can make significant dents in projected need on a business as usual case projection. Certainly improvements in renewables, certainly intermittent renewables such as wind, can also make a big dent. But at the same time, we do have a growing economy. We do have a growing population. We have growing loads on our electric system. So to postulate that we don't need any new additional generation facilities because renewables and energy conservation make that would take that place, I don't think is the case. Would we need as much as we would expect? I don't think so. I think I've answered the question as well as I possibly can.
Okay, thank you. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm just looking at the end of this ACEEE report, and it says the Northwest states, this is on the bottom of page 9, the Northwest's latest regional energy plan calls for meeting all demand growth through energy efficiency. And the Western Governors Association initiative is to increase the efficiency of energy use by 20% by 2020. And those are pretty aggressive goals. And I wonder if Deputy Commissioner Garvey could comment if he thinks we could meet those goals in Minnesota, and maybe that would help with the answer to the question that you were just addressing.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Anderson, it's certainly an admirable goal, and working with Senator Dibble, we have proposed and we are going to be presenting to you, and we have presented it through a bill that Chair Pretner Solon has proposed, is a 1.5% reduction through energy conservation and efficiency. And we think we can achieve that, but as you will hear for testimony from others, it's going to be a very significant stretch to achieve that. We need to put that in context. There are systems that are growing beyond 1.5%. There are systems that are growing at 2%, 3%. It's the nature of our dynamic and vibrant and growing economy. So to say, that's why my first question was, I think we need to do and we want to do, and I think we can dramatically reduce our need for additional electrical generation facilities, particularly baseload, but I don't think we can eliminate that, and I don't think we should plan and assume that we will. I think we should try to do as much as we can and take that into account in our long-term planning.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Garvey, do you think we can meet, as the Northwestern states are planning, could we meet all our demand growth through energy efficiency?
Deputy Commissioner.
Or maybe I should put it this way. If they can do it, why can't we?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Anderson, what they've established is a goal and a plan. What I'm sort of trying to sort of say is we're trying to do as much as we possibly can. I think we can achieve what we're going to propose. The question is, what is the link between, then you sort of say, we don't need any, ergo, we don't need any baseload. We don't need any new generation. We don't need any additional facility. Well, Matt, that's the question I'm trying to be, I'm trying to sort of say, I don't know the answer for sure, but I'd hate to say, no, we can basically conserve our way to eliminate new generation facilities in the state. That's the bridge I'm trying not to cross.
Madam
but
Chair,
I don't think I can.
I wasn't really asking
Senator
that question.
Anderson.
I was just asking whether we can, if you think we can eliminate demand growth through efficiency, which that those states are trying to do. And, you know, you don't have to answer the baseload question to answer that.
Madam
Deputy
Chairman, members of the committee, if we didn't have the demand growth, we wouldn't need a new facility unless to replace. I mean, uh-huh. That's... unless to replace a facility.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe we should
Senator Anderson
get some more information about how the Northwest states are planning to try to do that, because that is very, very ambitious.
Okay. And it seems that this isn't something that Deputy Commissioner can answer for us at this time, so we can look for other information. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
That's why I'm here, ma'am.
Senator Dipple.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and just you know, just for the record, I'm not interested in spearheading this effort, you know, explicitly. I don't want to make Senator Senjum anxious. I'm not here to kill off Big Stone or talk about the baseload issue. I do know though, you know, we certainly won't know unless we try, and we certainly do know the benefits that are available. Regardless of the answer to the question you asked, we know that the benefits that are available makes achieving the RES cheaper. It improves system reliability. It saves money for the customer. There are plenty of reasons to pursue this. Maybe we'll get to a point. Maybe we'll be so successful with decoupling and all these other concepts that we'll knock our own socks off and find out that a lot of our future demand can be achieved through savings and through other alternative forms, but there's a lot of good reasons to pursue this bill.
Okay. I don't think anybody's debating that.
I'm just adding to the love.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And we'll make copies of this and have it distributed before the close of the session.
Appreciate that. Yeah. Next speaker, Kevin Bengston.
Madam Chair, as we're transitioning to the hearing from other kinds of folks and stakeholders and the like, we do have, for folks who don't yet know, everyone, of course, is welcome. It's an open meeting. We are having a meeting tomorrow, we being myself, stakeholders, administration, advocates, at 10:30 tomorrow in room 318. Of course, there's a little wrinkle. We just found out that session is at 11. So I'll be there for the start. I'm sure folks will carry on very ably, and I'll try to dash back as soon as I can. Additionally, if folks, our plan for Thursday, we probably won't be able to have lots of specific bill language, but we'll have concepts on paper that we'll be able to testify to and talk about at Thursday's hearing. And if folks are wanting to testify, please, of course, let the able Jenny Myers know if you're interested in testifying.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bengston.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Kevin Bengston. I'm the Energy Services Coordinator at Moorhead Public Service, MPS for short. It's not very creative. MPS is a municipally owned electric, water, and wireless internet utility serving a community of about 33,000 people. I'm here today to talk about our participation in the Conservation Improvement Program, or CIP. My testimony will detail some of the numbers and programs relating to CIP and how it's delivered in Moorhead. But most importantly, I would like to share three underlying principles that guide our implementation of CIP programs in Moorhead. And the first is that local ownership and oversight guide our investments in CIP in our community. The second is that peak demand savings or capacity savings measured in kilowatts tend to be more cost-effective for us to achieve than energy savings measured in kilowatt hours. And the third is that our limitations in size and staff may present some challenges to implementing CIP, but those challenges aren't insurmountable. So the first principle is that local ownership and oversight guide our investment in CIP programs. Just a bit of history. In 1994, MPS convened a conservation program task force to determine which conservation programs we should offer our customers. Over a series of five meetings, a select group of our residential, commercial, and industrial customers became involved in the entire planning process for Moorhead's conservation programs. The end result of this task force was a report outlining the strategies that MPS should take regarding conservation spending and a recommendation on the creation of immediate and future conservation programs. This report was adopted by our governing board, the Moorhead Public Service Commission, and it still stands today as a tool and guideline for our creation of conservation programs. One of the problems that the task force examined was the issue relating to equity when it comes to conservation spending, or the question, where should we spend our money? In Moorhead, residential customers make up nearly 90% of our customer base, but they account for only about 40% of our electric sales, whereas the commercial and industrial customers, a group that we combine, are about 10% of our customer base and account for 60% of the sales. Our task force, which was made up of our customers, told us and made the recommendation that MPS should prioritize conservation program spending first to achieve the highest return and second to ensure equity in conservation program spending between the customer classes. In 2006, MPS budgeted $378,000 towards its CIP programs. This amount represents 1.86% of our electric gross operating revenue, which is about $20 million. It is just over the statutory requirement of 1.5%. The breakdown of our program spending, about 55% of our spending went to commercial industrial projects. The remaining 45% went to residential projects. So it was pretty close to our actual sales figures. Of that 45% of residential spending, about 5% was spent directly on low-income customer programs. Just recently, I received a review of MPS's 2006 plan from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Just got in the mail last week. Because of our municipal ownership and oversight, the department approval of our CIP was not required, but the agency reviews the compliance of our program with statutory requirements. It reviews our energy savings assumptions, checks our savings goals and our cost effectiveness, and provides suggestions to improve our programs. The department review of our program is very helpful to Moorhead. It gives us an idea of where we stand compared to other utilities and what we can do to improve our programs, and we are looking forward to that continuing relationship with the department to improve our programs. The second principle is that guiding our CIP implementation is that peak demand savings, or kilowatts, tend to be more cost-effective for us to achieve than energy savings in kilowatt hours. And really, maybe this is specific utility by utility, but our power resources impact which conservation programs we offer. MPS purchases all of its electricity from two entities. We receive a WAPA allocation, Western Area Power Administration, the Federal Power Marketing Agency. About 55% of our power needs come from the hydroelectric dams located along the Missouri River. The remainder is an all-requirements contract with Missouri River Energy Services, MRES. MRES provides the remaining 45% of our power, and that power, the majority of that power currently comes from a coal plant located in Wheatland, Wyoming, the Laramie River Generating Station. Just under 1% of our power needs are generated by our two wind turbines in Moorhead that are part of our green pricing program, the Capture the Wind program. Historically, the energy costs, or the kilowatt-hour cost of our power, has been very cheap, while the demand component, the kilowatts from MRES, has been more expensive. So the rate signals we receive from MRES encourage us to operate as efficiently as possible. And to do this, we need to control our peak demand. Controlling our peak demand saves our customers money, it keeps our rates low, and it does forestall the need to add additional power plant capacity. To achieve peak demand savings, we operate load management programs. We do a bit of fuel switching. We operate electric off-peak programs. We cycle residential hot water heaters, and we have a central air conditioning cycling program similar to what Xcel Energy offers around here called the Saver Switch program. We also call to interrupt or limit the consumption of some of our commercial customers who choose to be on an interruptible program. On the conservation side, what we've done to try to shave peak demand is we've invested in a lighting rebate program. We started a commercial lighting rebate program in 1995. It was one of the first programs that our customers told us that they wanted to see. It did have the highest payback for us, and it's been very successful, and it's been very cost-effective. It's still effective today. We do offer, since then, we have developed other conservation programs, and most of them rolled out here in 2000, in the 21st century here. We offer commercial and industrial customers a motor and variable speed drive program, and we also offer a custom rebate program, which is kind of a catch-all program to save energy. From a citywide basis, we're in year 3 of 4 of changing out all of our traffic signals from incandescent to LED. And in 2005, we started our first residential conservation programs. In 2005, we participated in the Energy Star Change-A-Light campaign, handing out compact fluorescent light bulbs. The programs I just mentioned are not as cost-effective from our utility cost standpoint. They tend to save energy, but they do very little from the peak demand savings standpoint, which we need to see a program be cost-effective. However, we do offer them anyway, per our customers, to provide equity in conservation program spending. In 2006, our programs are expected to save about 0.48% of our retail energy sales. In the future, Moorhead Public Service will continue to target programs that achieve peak demand savings as a primary goal for SIP, as they are the most cost-effective and also play an important role in our power supplier integrated resource plan. The final principle is that our limitations in size and staff may present challenges to implementing SIP, but those challenges are not insurmountable. About 75% of my time is dedicated to designing, implementing, and reporting our SIP programs. My philosophy on program design is, and it can't be, it's not to reinvent the wheel. Quite honestly, I don't have the time or the resources available to me to do the extensive research on energy-efficient technologies. So I utilize things such as our trade associations. In 2002, the Minnesota Municipal Utility Association worked with the Center for Energy and Environment to develop a template of conservation programs that municipals could offer their customers. And these programs turned out to be very useful to us. I also look at what neighboring utilities offer, because if I don't look at that, my customers will tell me what they're offering. I don't know how many times I've been called on the phone from a customer wanting to sign up for the Saver Switch. But I look to see what the leaders are doing nationwide, just like you looked at the ACEEE report that was just in front of you, to see what programs are very successful, and I try to adopt those methods. And finally, we also utilize outside contractors. For example, in 2006, we did the Change of Light campaign once again, but to improve the cost effectiveness of it, I hired a contractor this time, Midwest Energy Efficiency Association out of Chicago, to administer and deliver the rebates for this program, and it seemed to work very well. We had a successful campaign this year rebating over 4,000 CFLs, and we plan on doing that again. I'd like to conclude today by saying that the Conservation Improvement Program in Moorhead has been an essential demand-side management tool and has provided a good value to our customers. Just to reiterate some of the numbers I said, MPS budgets about 1.86% of its revenue to achieve 0.48% energy savings. We feel that the principles that guide our investment in SIP, the local ownership and oversight, the emphasis on peak demand savings, and efficient use of human resources do a good job in helping us operate as efficiently as possible for our customer owners. Thanks.
Mr. Bankson, do you make use of all energy conservation that's available to you? Do you implement it all?
Do I implement it all? Every program that's out there, Madam Chair? No. I mean, there are programs that XL Energy Minnesota is offering right now. There are programs, plenty of programs out there that we have yet to delve into. For instance, Energy Star appliances. We have not yet gotten into residential Energy Star appliances. As one example.
So there are opportunities for further conservation.
There are opportunities for further conservation, Madam Chair. It's just that we've tried to target the programs that save peak demand savings first.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam
Questions?
Chair. Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bingstrom, actually, Madam Chair, did have my question, but have you set a goal? You said you're at 1.86%. Do you have a goal for 2%, or are you currently happy with that?
Mr. Bankson.
Madam Chair and Senator, our goal right now is to meet the statutory requirement of 1.5%. The reason we probably spent more than that this year is because there were some opportunities out there that were cost-effective for us to pursue, and so we did so. And cost-effective to us means that they actually had a downward pressure on our rates. So we pursue that because it means a, rate balancing. So,
Madam Chair, you will continue to keep those programs and stay around the 1.86%, I would assume.
Mr. Bankson.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator, we're planning to keep the programs and we're planning to continue to meet and we're planning to meet the statutory requirement of 1.5%. That's our goal each year now, since it is a spending requirement goal. If we exceed it cost effectively, we exceed it. But it's not the goal to try to get up to 2% spending or 3% spending or anything like that.
No. Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I'm curious when you talk about you switched your stoplights to LEDs. Are you looking at things like with all your streetlights and those kinds of things to save energy or?
Mr. Bankson.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator, that's a great question because I just stumbled upon a great web resource. The City of Raleigh is looking at changing out their street lighting to LED. It's pretty new, is my understanding. I don't know of any vendors yet that carry it, but we're doing all of our street lights. We're doing our traffic signals. Excuse me. We're doing all of our traffic signals. We're doing all of our pedestrian signals, and we're going to have all of those done by the end of next year. And, we're just going to wait to see where the LED lighting technology takes us because that's certainly, there's a lot of room for, I think there's a lot of development. I can't speak on the technology side. It seems like they have a long ways to go, but things are happening on that. So,
thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, Senator Dipple has a question.
Thanks. I just wanted to mention the 1.5%. I'm just reminded that, the 1.5% that's conceived of in the governor's bill and in my bill happens to be the 1.5% savings, but there's also 1.5% statutory requirement for spending in the current statute. And people hear the 1.5% and they happen to be the same numbers, but they're not related to each other. So 1.5% gets thrown around a lot, and then people get distracted by one or the other. Happen to be the same number, but they're different things and not always connected to each other.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Gary Connett.
Oh, great.
Did you get this letter? Is this just read down to you.
Mr. Connett.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senators. I've never testified before, so if I blow this in terms of the protocol, please, I apologize ahead of time.
We'll help you.
it's been quite a day for me already. I actually started out my day in Duluth.
The first thing that you can do is just give us your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Gary Connett, and I am manager of the Demand Side Management and Member Services for Great River Energy in Elk River. I started out my day in Duluth, Minnesota this morning. I got up there last night in a snowstorm, and as I was taking my clothes out of the back of the car, I dropped my suit in the parking ramp. the slacks fell off the hanger, and the tie went with them. And so I don't think the tie's recoverable. I'm hoping the slacks can be dry cleaned and come out okay. But I was up in Duluth this morning to give a opening remarks to an energy design conference that is in its 17th year. And it's an energy design conference that Great River Energy and Minnesota Power co-sponsor. 17 years ago, it was held at a Best Western hotel in Duluth, and there was probably about 30 people there, and I was a speaker at it then. They asked me back today to be the keynote speaker, if you will. There was 1,300 people in the auditorium this morning at the DEC Convention Center. Builders, developers, architects, home buyers, all interested in making sure or understanding how they can build an energy-efficient home. It was incredible. It started out with probably 40 or 50 customers 17 years ago, but we had to stop registrations because we had filled to capacity. That wouldn't have happened without Great River Energy and Minnesota Power taking an initiative and saying, you know what, we need to do this for our customers. Great River Energy. I want to give you, if you don't mind, a snapshot of who Great River Energy is. Great River Energy is a G&T, a generation and transmission cooperative, and we're located in Elk River, Minnesota, and we serve 28 distribution cooperatives. Our member cooperatives are really a diverse group, and I get to work with them every day, and I love it. They stretch from the southwestern region of the Minnesota down in the farm country, if you will. A lot of our co-ops down there aren't growing at all. They're losing population, as a matter of fact. And then it winds through and up into the lake country and logging industry of the Arrowhead region of Minnesota. And we also serve some of the outer ring suburbs of the Twin Cities, some of the fastest growing suburbs in all of the United States. One of the ways that utilities often measure themselves is in customer density. And the way we do that is we use how many customers per mile of distribution lines. That would be a benchmark that all utilities could use to determine how they stack up. At Great River Energy, we average 7 customers per mile of distribution line. We have many cooperatives that have less than 3 customers per mile of distribution line. Particularly in southwestern Minnesota, Nobles Electric in Worthington, Redwood Electric in Clemens, Federated in Jackson, Minnesota, Brown County Cooperative in Sleepy Eye, AgriLite in Benson, Minnesota, South Central in St. James, Minnesota. There are some of the co-ops, about a third of them, that have less than 3 customers per mile of distribution line. We have other co-ops that are much larger. We're the wholesale provider for energy for Conexus Energy, which is in Ramsey, Minnesota, and they have over 100,000 customers, about 15 customers per mile of distribution line. And we also serve Dakota Electric. Dakota Electric is located in Farmington, Minnesota, and they too have 100,000 customers or more, and they have somewhere around 23 customers per mile of distribution line. Great River Energy sales are 60% goes to residential customers, and about 38% goes to C&I, or commercial and industrial customers, and 2% goes to what we call seasonal customers. Another interesting note about our customers, and we only serve them electricity, is that 90% of our customers heat their homes with something other than electricity. They heat their homes with natural gas, propane, or fuel oil. 90% of them do. 60% of our customers heat their hot water needs with something other than electricity, too. They heat their water with natural gas or propane, and in some cases, fuel oil. I manage a staff of 5 people, including myself, and we're responsible for the demand-side management programs. And by demand-side management, I mean both load management programs, which Kevin spoke to, and our conservation programs as well. We submit our SIP filing every other year to the Department of Commerce, and we aggregate that filing on behalf of all 28 member cooperatives. In 2005, the last year that we reported, GRE and its members spent approximately $18 million on load management and conservation. Let me explain. great or cooperatives and I think municipals, we get to spend 50. We have to spend up to 50% of our spending has to be on conservation programs. The other half can be on load management. In 2005, we spent $18 million. Our SIP requirement was to spend $12 million approximately. So we exceeded our spending. And it's not uncommon that we do. Great River Energy looks at conservation as a least cost option, if you will. And it was interesting to hear the conversations with Mr. Shirley earlier. Because how we approach conservation is we ask ourselves, is it less expensive to save a kilowatt hour than it is to generate a kilowatt hour? And if it is, shouldn't we have a program to save it? And that's really a simple way that we look at conservation. If it's less expensive to save a kilowatt hour than it is to make one, let's try to save them. And ultimately, that's the best for our members. It'll keep their rates the lowest. And so that's our real simple approach that we take to conservation. It's if it's less expensive. Kevin mentioned load management, and that's a really critical program for Great River Energy as well. What's load management? Load management is the ability to alter how customers are using energy through a load management device, if you will. Great River Energy is different than Xcel. It's different than Minnesota Power. And it's important that you know that utilities are different. Our load curve, and that's kind of a crazy term maybe, but our load curve, and that's how we use electricity on any given day, and it's our load curve is predominantly determined by how each of us use electricity in our homes. If you take a typical residential home and you multiply that times 500,000 homes, you get a load curve that looks very much like Great River Energy's. We have a peak in the morning. It occurs around 7 in the morning. And that's each of you watching Good Morning America, turning on the coffee pot, and doing these sort of things you do before you go to work. And then the demand for energy goes down after 7 in the morning. It has a valley, we call it. And that valley stays down there until around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then our load goes ballistic. It goes straight up. It goes up because we're all coming home from work. And we're all turning on 2 TV sets, 3 computers, 3 coffee pots, a cook stove, doing clothes, all these things that we have to do in our homes. And by 7 o'clock, we have our highest demand for the day. And then after 7, it starts to go down. And by midnight, it's tanked down to a real low valley, and we start the day over. And that's our load curve, day after day after day almost. That's different than Minnesota Power. It's different than Xcel's. And it's because of who we are. I like to think of it as our thumbprint. And we have to design programs, and we have to design power plants based on our load curve. GRE funds all the rebate programs for our conservation programs. This year, in 2007, we've funded about $5 million for energy efficiency rebates. I'm not talking load management now. I'm talking about energy conservation. Our $5 million goes out to the co-ops, and it rebates residential appliances like Energy Star appliances, air conditioners, lighting, energy audits, a number of programs, lighting, for example, programs that you can use in your home to make yourself more efficient. The $5 million also goes to agricultural customers for plate heat exchangers and other types of devices to take the waste heat from dairy farms and use it. Our $5 million also goes to fund our commercial and industrial customers, funds them for putting in better lighting, better motors, variable speed drives, better heating and ventilating and air conditioning equipment in their buildings. And it's sort of interesting to note, too, that we all have commercial and industrial customers. All of the utilities do. But ours, for the most part, are fairly small. We don't serve the large communities in our service territory. And I'll back up for a minute and tell you that we serve 60% of the geographical area of Minnesota, all the way from the northern border to the southern border. But when you look in our service territory, you can pick out the cities, and for the most part, we don't serve them. We don't serve Ely. We don't serve Grand Marais. We don't serve Brainerd. We don't serve Park Rapids. We don't serve Worthington, Granite Falls. The list goes on. We pretty much serve the rural area of Minnesota, other than, of course, Conexus and Dakota, who are serving some of those outer ring suburbs. That's our customer base. And when you go into that customer base and you start looking at the commercial and industrial customers, often they're still sort of ma and pa hardware stores, convenience stores, strip mall sort of things. And yeah, we do have the occasional big loads. We do. And we're getting a lot of ethanol plants. And those are absolutely huge. When I was writing my notes to this, I wanted to be so bold as to give you some suggestions in terms of the legislation that you're working on. And I've been in the SIP business for about 13 years for Great River Energy. And prior to that, I had another 18 years at Great River Energy. So I've been up there for 30 years. And I really, really have a commitment to conservation. I wrote down some notes to myself. And if you don't mind, I'll share them with you. Suggestions for improvement. One of my first suggestions would consider leaving it as a spending requirement. Today it's 1.5% of our gross revenue. One thing about using a revenue requirement, it's easy to account for. Every accountant can tell you how much your gross revenue is. It's easy to keep the bookkeeping straight. When you switch it to something in terms of a conservation requirement, it's a little harder to measure conservation. It can be done, but I think we've got a pretty good formula in place already, and we've been working with the Department of Commerce and other utilities to put standards in place. And I think standards are critically important. And what I mean by that is when Great River Energy gets customers to put in a high-efficient air conditioner or a high-efficient refrigerator, the savings that we achieve should be the same whether they're in Great River Energy service territory or Excel's, or Minnesota Power's, or Otter Tail's. We ought to all agree that we have the same standards for energy savings, and we're getting there. And so I don't know if there's anything wrong with the way we're doing it today, but there's a lot we can do in terms of energy standards. And if we don't do that, and we truly go to an energy savings goal, consider a phase-in of that energy savings goal. Senator Anderson mentioned the Northwest utilities, 20% by 2020 or 20% in 20 years, something like that. That comes out to be 1% a year annually. Great River today, and I like to think we do a good job, we do about 0.3% in terms of energy savings each year. 0.3%. If it were to go to 1.5%, I don't think I can do it. I don't think my co-ops can do it. We'd have to really pull the stops out somehow to do this. Keep in mind, most of my customers are residential. Most of their heating is gas. Most of their water heating is gas. I'm left with air conditioners. 30% of our customers, no, I'll take that back, 60% of our customers have air conditioners, and it's getting higher and higher every day. It used to be nobody had central air conditioning. Now everybody's going to have it. Today, we have about 330,000 customers with central air conditioners. Of that 330,000 customers with central air conditioners, we cycle 120,000 of those, or about 30%. That's incredible. Not many utilities can say that they have 30% saturation in cycled air conditioning. Every air conditioner that we cycle, we reduce our demand by 1 kW. You do enough of those, you've built yourself a peaking plant. We're building a peaking plant today in Cambridge, Minnesota, that'll be about 170 megawatts in the summertime. Through load management, Great River Energy is able to reduce its peak demand by about 330 megawatts. That's two of those peaking plants.
Okay, Mr. Conant, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. Well, a couple of other thoughts in terms of changing. Rate design. There was some information in the Federal Energy Policy Act that considered having utilities look at variable pricing in their rate design. That is a way of saving energy through rate design, having a critical peak pricing period, for example. Lastly, one of the things that's very frustrating for me is that we are going to have about 60% of the residential growth in our service territory. 60% of the residential growth is in our service territory. We don't have a very good enforcement of the building code. When we get out into our service territory, a lot of things are being done in homes that shouldn't be done. And we're out trying to promote energy efficiency, but on the other hand, some of the building codes could be enforced much better. you know, I'll quit there and I'll take any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Quickly.
Senator Olsen.
You know, your new facility is going to be kind of a state-of-the-art with energy savings. Are you going to be promoting those kind of energy savings onto your customers?
Commissioner, sorry, yes. And when he speaks of our new facility, he's speaking of our new headquarters building. Our new headquarters building is under construction in Maple Grove, Minnesota, and it's going to be a LEED Platinum certified facility. And we're intending it to be a showcase. And we've gone, you know, beyond what we probably should have on that building. But we did it deliberately to show our customers, who we've been telling for years to consider energy efficiency in their new homes and businesses, we need to show them that we can do it too. We have to kind of put our money where our mouth is, so to speak. Okay. And so it's intended to be open to the public for tours and a showcase for others to consider.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, when you mentioned the building code lack of enforcement, like what kinds of things are you thinking of?
Years ago, and not too many years ago, I'd get into homes and we'd be putting in geothermal heat pumps or something, and I'd get into a home and there'd be no insulation on the rim joists of a new home. There'd be no cold air return in the new home. And you'd ask the homeowner, how come you don't have a cold air return in this house? And they'd go, I don't know what one is. Sub-quality installation of insulation and furnaces and so on. It's just nobody's out there looking for it in the rural areas.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
And the next speaker is Stephen Gunn. And I would ask people to remember to try to keep your comments to 5 minutes or less.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. I'll be brief. For the record, my name is Stephen Gunn. I am the manager of the Conservation Improvement Program for Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation. Minnesota Energy Resources is a natural gas distribution utility serving 165 communities throughout Minnesota. We serve 207 natural gas customers, and many of these are in rural areas. We believe that the SIP program is an important part of the energy landscape and support it fully. Our planned SIP spending for the 2007-2008 biennium is $4.4 million, which represents a spending of 0.7% of gross operating revenue. Total planned energy savings for the same biennium is approximately 233,000 MCF or million cubic feet. And during the 2005 program year, which is the last year for which I have complete data, 8,325 individuals and companies participated in the SIP program. This represents approximately 4% of customers of all rate classes. Program staffing, I am the manager of the program, so most of my time is dedicated to this program. In addition to the staff, in addition to me, we have others within our organization that provide support in the regulatory area and in customer service. So there are a number of representatives there. We also use vendors to actually do the program implementation for us. As a project overview, program opportunities are somewhat limited compared to what you might find in a gas or in an electric utility, but we think we do a good job of finding the best opportunities for our customers. We have a low-income weatherization program, which offers weatherization services to low-income customers. Participants are also eligible for high-efficiency gas furnace and water heater replacements, and we deliver this program with Community Action of Minneapolis as our program manager, and the local CAP agencies are actually the delivery channel for these programs. We have a nonprofit affordable housing project, which creates a partnership with nonprofit organizations such as Habitat for Humanity. And this program helps build energy efficient housing for low-income customers. And It provides incentives for the full incremental cost for these organizations to upgrade to high-efficiency furnaces and waterheads, install low-flow showerheads, and setback thermostats, as an example. We provide residential energy audits to customers to help them understand how energy is being used in their homes, and we provide approximately $30 worth of weatherization materials that they can install in their homes to further reduce energy costs. We provide a residential heating rebate, which gives customers incentive to install high-efficiency gas furnaces in their homes. We also provide commercial and industrial customers with rebates when they install natural gas equipment in their facilities, which also result in energy efficiency improvements. And we will also provide a rebate to customers that conduct energy audits in their facilities. We will rebate them up to 50% of the cost of their audit when they actually implement some of the audit recommendations for their program. As I said earlier, we're very supportive of the SIP program, and we would like to just say that the low-income programs have had great participation and acceptance by customers and others in our service territory, and we look forward to providing these programs in the future. That's the end of my remarks. Thank you.
So, Mr. Gunn, your current conservation rate is 0.7%,
is
that
correct?
That's correct. How much higher do you think you can achieve?
Well, rather than increase spending, which the regulatory amount is 0.5% for gas utilities, we continually review the programs we're currently offering, and we do a cost-benefit analysis of the potential programs, and then we pick those programs that are the best producers for our customers. So we can increase energy savings, hopefully, while maintaining our cost to customers at the current spending levels.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions or comments? Okay, thank you for your comments. Next speakers are Larry Johnston and Kelly Lady.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. And I have the privilege of having Kelly Lady with me today. She's the Energy Services Consultant from Austin Utilities. I'm just going to hit very quickly on a couple points that are coming around on the sheet, give you a little bit of feel for what SEMPA does in terms of supporting its members on SIP. And then you'll have a chance to hear from Kelly, because Austin happens to be a municipal gas utility, and so that's a little bit different flavor. We'll give you an opportunity to find out about on the municipal gas side of things. Very quickly, as you know, SEMPA serves 18 municipal utilities around the state. The top box on the sheet that you're going to see there that ultimately has our logo on it, so you'll recognize it when it comes around. Lists our communities in kind of three groups. The Triad, our three largest members, Austin, Owatonna, and Rochester, do an awful lot of joint marketing together, joint implementation together. The next seven members are kind of broken out in terms of the state's current SIP reporting requirements that need to report the full version, if you will, of the reporting requirement. And then the eight members that are listed below that are our smaller members that have to do all the programs, that need to do all the SIP investment, but can, in fact, do an abbreviated reporting format. So that's out there. I just want to let you know that since 1993, we've designed and, through our members, have implemented a suite of programs for both residential and commercial industrial customers. I'm not going to go through them. They're on the very back page of this. You can look through them. I do just want to highlight one thing there. There's probably 13-plus technologies that we have on the residential side. There's probably 9-plus technologies that we're working with, rolled-up technologies on the commercial industrial programs. The check mark is just to illustrate one thing. We continually look for innovative approaches for new things to develop and offer to the customers in terms of high-efficiency alternatives. We're one of about three utilities in the nation that's trying to do something in terms of energy-efficient dehumidifiers. They're huge energy hogs, really only second to your central air conditioner. And more and more houses being tighter to try to, you know, conserve on their heating and cooling costs are generally dehumidifying on a more regular basis. So this is something we've come up with kind of an innovative approach on that. We have a low-income program that we've just put together in the last couple of years. It's kind of a twist on what we've done historically. It really kind of concentrates on our ability to lower electric energy costs for low-income customers by working with them in terms of Energy Star appliances and replacing old inefficient appliances with high-efficiency appliances. You'll see about in the middle of the page there, we're very proud of this. Our members, we have been National Energy Star Award winners in 2003 and 2004 for our program efforts. We are very proud of that. That's a very select group of people that end up either competing for that and ultimately winning in that, and that's from the US DOE and EPA. Just a couple summary statistics there. Our conservation improvement programs in 2005, the required spending at the 1.5% was about $2.9 million. The actual spending was a little over that, $3-plus million, about 12.3 million kilowatt hours saved in the program. And if you look at that in kind of a, on that program year, dollars per kilowatt hour saved, it's roughly $23 a kilowatt hour, kind of right in the middle of the pack of the statistics that have come around from the department in terms of looking at that. I think Excel's down in the 13 cent range, but then you can find people up in the 54 cent range as well. So kind of in the middle of the pack. Again, as municipal utilities, we kind of see ourselves as doing this. We can't see our customers being inefficient in the first place, and it allows us to defer investment in plant and equipment. So that's just a quick summary of SEMPA, and Kelly can now give you a feel for the gas side of things.
Thank you, Larry, Madam Chair, and the committee. My name is Kelly Lady, and as Larry said, I'm with Austin Utilities, and I'm here representing a group of three municipal utilities. We call ourselves the Triad, and we started doing joint development and marketing of SIP programs about 6 years ago now and have found it to be more effective and cost-saving. Instead of having a staff of two people as we currently have when we all get together, then suddenly we have a staff of eight. So currently our natural gas utilities are required to spend 0.5% of revenues for the 0405 filing. Our budget was roughly $144,000 for the 0607 filing. It's roughly $246,000. That's a 71% increase, and that's largely come from the price increase of the natural gas commodity in 2005. Our average cost per MCF saved for the 0405 filing was $13. For 0607, we're budgeting $15.30 an MCF. Part of that is because we've made an effort to increase our low-income spending. You have to give a larger incentive to that class to get them to participate. And we've also done some increased spending in indirect programs. I'll talk a little more about that in a moment. Our MCF savings as a percentage of our sales has ranged between 0.25 and 0.35%. And we need to remember that conservation programs are measured against a minimum efficiency. And as those minimum efficiencies are increased, it is harder to achieve that savings. And the example I'm giving is we used to have a 92% efficient furnace incentive for new home construction, but with new building codes, it was standard for people to be putting in the 90 to 92% efficient furnaces. We didn't have to provide that incentive. We bumped it up to a 94% efficient, but then the we're having to measure the savings between a 92 and a 94% efficient technology, so that savings is smaller than we used to when we used to measure it against the 80% efficiency level. And we're using the same type of programs that you've been hearing about, the furnaces, the water heaters, the thermostats, the attic insulation, water heaters, and we're doing that for all of our classes of customers have different opportunities. Some of the indirect spending that we're doing, and we can't report savings with indirect spending, But we do find that it is a important part of educating customers so that they take advantage of the incentives that we offer. We're doing some training with our contractors, such as high-efficiency water heaters, with our customers, some steam trap maintenance. We provide energy audits for all class of customers. We are present at the fairs and the home shows in our community, telling people the opportunities that we have for them. And in closing, I would like to add that we value our conservation programs. We've been working with the other utilities to build a brand that we call Conserve and Save, and this is just being smeared across the three communities. This is a tag that goes on all appliances that are eligible for rebates, and we put it on all of our marketing material, and we put it on our rebate forms, and it's just now starting to kick in and be popular, where customers are now looking for that brand name so that they can associate that with a rebate and some energy-saving opportunities. We really feel that we've developed a close relationship with our customers and our trade allies and organizations that are serving low-income customers, and we are committed to helping our customers use energy wisely. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Just a small question. Ms. Lady, do you also get your ideas of conservation to put into your program from the same pool, and what was the name of that, the same area? I mean, where are these ideas coming from? And
We're looking at the larger utilities and what they're doing and best practices in the industry, as well as trying to be innovative also.
Okay. Senator Sparks.
And I think that, Ms. Lady, thank you for coming up from Austindale. She brings up a good point that I think we have to take into consideration. This triad has been a wonderful organization. It really does allow them to get out there and do some TV commercials, and I know that firsthand. She's been at the fairs and home shows, and I think we should maybe take a look at some of that indirect spending, because we can do a lot here to try to promote conservation. I think that's what we're going to try to do. But ultimately, we have to educate those customers, too, so they know that these programs are available and they can take advantage of it. And so I think that that is a key part of her testimony that we should consider as we move forward.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you for recognizing that, because with the energy savings requirement, our fear is that we're not going to be able to give as much dollars to those indirect programs that we feel are so important.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Given the hour of the day, you may want to pursue this at another time, but you remember on Thursday there were some questions asked in our climate change hearing of Deb Bergen. I do have responses to those. If you want to spend just a moment with those, I could touch on them quickly. If the timing is poor, we could perhaps do that at another time.
Mr. Johnston, you're speaking on Thursday, right?
Yes.
Would you mind bringing it up at that time?
That would be fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker is Angie Klein.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Angie Klein. I'm with CenterPoint Energy, and I manage all the energy efficiency programs for the company in Minnesota. Susan just brought the packet. I have a presentation that I have for all of you folks to follow along. I'm going to go as quickly as I can, looking at the time, and there's still a lot of speakers that have to go. There's three topics I'd like to go over with you today. First, just a general overview of CenterPoint Energy's conservation programs over the last several years with participation, energy savings, and the expenditures. Additionally, I'd like to go over our current programs. And part of the packet, I believe, that was put together for you today includes a one-pager that has more details on residential, because that's where we tend to have more questions, but there is detailed questions about each and every rebate, what the rebate level is, so I'm not going to go into all that detail today, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. And the third thing I'd like to do today is talk about what we really see as key to implementing successful energy efficiency programs. Deputy Commissioner Garvey really went through the regulatory environment and process in Minnesota, that there's a statutory spending requirement For natural gas and electric utilities. For natural gas, which we are in Minnesota only, it's 0.5% of gross operating revenues. There's regulatory procedures in place as far as the recovery of those expenses, financial incentive for utilities that go above and beyond what the statutory requirements are in a cost-effective manner. Our history in providing energy conservation, the statutes on energy efficiency really started kicking in 1992, so I just went back that far. Since that point, we have spent over $85 million on conservation. We have realized essentially 9.0 billion cubic feet of natural gas energy savings. And to put it in perspective of what that means, since most people don't know what an MCF or a BCF or a therm is, it's equivalent to basically the annual energy usage of approximately 90,000 residential customers. And one thing to keep in mind is that's not just a one-time energy savings. That's for the life of the equipment, which in most cases for natural gas is at least 15 years. And many of the pieces of equipment, such as a boiler, would be for 20, 30 years that a school will replace it once, and then that's it. And the next time it gets replaced, it's likely to be even more efficient than what was in there. So that's a pretty tremendous amount of energy savings. We have had over 200,000 customers, and that's residential, commercial, and industrial customers participate over that period of time. And there was talk earlier about ACEEE, CenterPoint Energy's programs. Three of our programs are recognized by ACEEE, which is really the premier energy efficiency organization, as having exemplary natural gas programs that they would encourage other utilities around the country to replicate. And I can go into those a little bit more when we go through the programs. Finally, around the country, Minnesota and CenterPoint Energy really are recognized as a leader in conservation energy efficiency for natural gas. And my understanding is we are one of the largest natural gas efficiency programs in the country at this point. Historical energy savings, I put this in for the next slide just to kind of show us a percentage of throughput. We historically have been right around 0.6% of throughput, and that's really, we're very aggressive on our goals, but that just shows where we're at for the historical. Moving on to what our current program is for 2007-2008, it was recently approved in October by the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and our expenditure level is $8.4 million of annual expenditures. Over 32,000 participants, and that's for all three markets, residential, commercial, and industrial, and over 880,000 decatherms of energy savings. And I'm going to go into a little more detail on where those savings actually occur. One thing that I think is important is that the expenditures for our programs are evenly split between the residential and commercial industrial market segment, which roughly reflect what our throughput distribution is, and we really feel strongly that we like to have direct impact, i.e. a rebate for the installation of a high-efficiency boiler or furnace, along with educational programs like audits and materials to show customers how they can cost-effectively save energy in their home. Our 2007-2008 biennial plan that was just approved, like I said, the budget is roughly half and half between residential, commercial, industrial. But as you can see here, 81% of the energy savings that we will achieve is associated with the commercial industrial market. And in particular, it's really the industrial that drives it. Our residential usage is low, and it continues to decrease. And so the opportunities on the residential side continue to diminish. And so there's just not a lot of incremental savings that we can get from the residential market. Finally, participation, of course, is skewed toward the residential only because that's where our customers are. Our 2007-2008 biennial plan, we have, as I said, residential, commercial, and industrial programs. We have typical things like residential water heater rebate, residential furnace. We have low-flow shower heads that we provide customers free of charge. We have our low-income weatherization that we partner with Community Action Minneapolis and the other 20 CAP agencies within our service territory. We have nonprofit affordable housing, which works with nonprofits like Twin City Habitat and all the other habitat organizations around the state, along with all the other nonprofits that provide low-income affordable housing to encourage them to put in high-efficiency natural gas equipment as compared to just standard efficiency, which is cheaper upfront. On the commercial industrial side, one thing that's unusual for us, not only in Minnesota but around the country, is we have a very extensive food service rebate program. We have 10 different pieces of equipment that are more efficient uses of cooking or preparing food in schools, hospitals, nursing homes, and restaurants. And we're very proud of that program. We also have a training center associated with that. And, of course, there's rebates, and this is, like I said, our largest energy savings are associated with custom process rebates. So an ethanol plant in Greater Minnesota that puts in a more efficient grain dryer would generate tremendous amount of energy savings, and we do about 60, 70 of those projects a year around the state, and frankly, many of them are in Greater Minnesota. I was asked to do our customer market segment overview, so where do our customers kind of break out? And I have an addendum to this that shows exactly how many customers we have, but roughly 92% of our customers as far as number of customers, so 780 out of our 780, roughly 80 or 90% of those are residential. And as far as throughput, it's essentially split. One thing I want to point out is our program at this time, we have rebates for encouraging higher efficiency natural gas for 7 pieces of equipment on the natural gas side on the residential. And on the electric side, I just looked at Xcel Electric since they're the most comprehensive. They've got about 33 different technologies. On the commercial industrial market, for natural gas, we have 26. And on the electric side, there's more than 200. And I think that somewhat gets to the questions that were asked, you know, how comprehensive your programs are, Senator Rosen. And we really are not aware of anything that we could be providing rebates on the natural gas side that we're not already doing. So we're really to that point of doing what we can, and we really pride ourselves on that. Finally, we were asked specifically to talk about the delivery mechanisms, and there's really almost a two-tiered. We almost approach it depending upon what the program is and who's in the best position to deliver that program. And frankly, a lot of our programs for the commercial industrial are delivered by internal staff, and that's technical folks, sales folks, marketing folks, folks that work with mechanical contractors and consulting engineers, and then there's also the regulatory staff, and that's for most. That's for essentially all the commercial and industrial programs. We also work closely with external vendors for commercial audits, residential audits, community action agencies, fulfillment vendors for certain programs. So it's really different ways to deliver and different folks within our organization that are working closely with that subset of customers. Finally, we really think that the key to a successful energy efficiency program is having cost recovery, contemporaneous cost recovery, so cost recovery, knowing full well up front that that's going to be the expectation, which is allowed in statute, coupled with a regulatory mechanism to recognize the throughput disincentive associated with energy efficiency. And Mr. Shirley's presentation earlier talked about the differences between the gas and the electric, and I think it's really important for you folks to know that on the gas side we have declining use per customer. So for us to be aggressively implementing energy efficiency, that just exacerbates our load. So I think the true solution is to have a combination of the two in order to recognize that our profits are going down directly as a result of this. So, and I'm happy to answer any questions about any of our programs or and like I said, there's an appendix that has kind of just a quick overview of CenterPoint Energy, but I believe our legislative folks have met with each of you and given you detailed information about the company, so I didn't want to go into that detail. So,
okay. Any questions? Okay, thank you, Ms.
Thank
Klein.
You.
Next, I'm going to jump to Sue Thompson. Welcome, Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I, too, started my morning in Duluth, Minnesota, and we wouldn't have to limit the attendance at the Energy Design Conference if we had a larger deck. As I mentioned, I'm Sue Thompson, and I'm the Director of Customer Service for Minnesota Power. My staff has the Development, Management, and Delivery of Minnesota Power's SIP program. Thank you for the opportunity to share information about our conservation efforts and our views on SIP. We've used SIP as an integral part of customer service effort at Minnesota Power, and we believe it's part of our overall responsibility as an electricity provider to help our customers get value and satisfaction out of their energy use. Effective SIP programs are one way we deliver on those goals. Our SIP programs have been a way for us to help customers save money and, just as importantly, employ new technology to enhance their homes and businesses. We have been steadily increasing our KWH hours, saved through SIP, as well as increasing our monetary investment and exceeding our minimum spending requirements on programs. For an example, in 2006, we saved nearly 40 million KWH, which is approximately 22% increase in savings compared to the 2004 energy savings. In terms of dollars spent, we invested $3.8 million in 2006, and that also was an increase of 22%, well over the $3.1 million that was spent in 2004. That $3.8 million was also nearly $1 million more than our minimum spending requirement. Our SIP programs are funded in proportion to the revenues from the customers that are served. In 2007, we'll have equivalent staff of just under 5 people working on program design and delivery. We have about 140,000 customers in total. The largest categories of customers within our SIP efforts are approximately 116,000 residential, served by Energy Partners, our low-income program, and Triple E Plus programs, and about 20,000 commercial and industrial accounts served by our Power Grant program. And I'll just quickly define those programs. In terms of our low-income efforts, which we call Energy Partners, the CAP agencies we employ deliver SIP in conjunction with weatherization and other efforts. This reduces costs for identifying and qualifying customers, and it avoids duplicate delivery, making more funds available for those that are served. This positive leveraging of program resources creates an ownership by those CAP agencies for the program. Our Triple E Plus program promotes Energy Star appliances, efficient lighting, air conditioning, heat pump, motor applications. It also includes high-efficiency building techniques for electrically heated homes. Some measures under Triple E are prescriptive in nature, and some measures calculate energy savings performance based on construction, and then we apply a rebate on cents per kWh basis. Lastly, Power Grant serves a commercial, industrial, and agricultural community. Rebates for the Power Grant program are based on energy save, which encourages customers to find additional energy savings. Power Grant customers become participants in finding the energy savings with real incentive to find more and not just replace equipment. They do more than fill out a form and wait for the check. The flexibility of Power Grant to adapt to an energy save where it's found makes this program a success. This Power Grant program was identified as innovative and a successful program several years ago by Oak Ridge National Labs, a federally funded national program research leader in conservation and other energy matters. Our programs are designed to establish a partnership between the utility, third-party contractors, and retailers to meet the needs of our customers. And we jointly design and market those programs so that we all achieve greater success. All of our SIP programs rely on the flexible approach to rewarding energy savings where they're found, regardless of whether a specific end-use program had been anticipated prior to the plan. In fact, Minnesota Power's conservation efforts were recognized at a national level in 2004 when we also won the Energy Star EPA DOE Award for Excellence in Regional, State, and Community Leadership in Energy Efficiency. We were only one of 5 utilities in the country to be recognized in this category. And given our size and our fairly rural service territory, we feel this award says a lot about how seriously we take energy conservation and how hard we work to get it successfully delivered to our customers. Now, in closing, in regard to our current success and any legislative changes to SIP, Minnesota Power recommends the use of historic base year with a projected cap reflecting load growth for calculating savings goals. Historic projected years would change to consider plan timing. For example, if a filing for a 2008 through 2010 SIP plan, the base year would be 2006, and the cap would reflect load growth based on the average growth over that time period of 2008 to 2010 as compared to 2006. Furthermore, any legislation should continue to ensure that low-income savings are included in utility results and that exempted load is excluded from savings goals. Secondly, Minnesota Power further recommends that the utilities be allowed first opportunity to provide SIP programs to their customers at their option, with the Department of Commerce programs only serving as a backstop. For an example, Minnesota Power's low-income program is working. And as it's a significant part of our overall programming, approximately 20% of our residential savings are from that low-income program. And we should be allowed the first opportunity to continue to offer that program. Similarly, the R&D program. Our program is working, and we'd like the opportunity to deliver on those programs with the DOC as a backstop. And third, finally, when considering program flexibility, Minnesota Power recommends that SIP encourage new products and technology. Regarding waste heat recovery, this committee had heard from our company recently about promising waste heat recovery applications that we're investigating that can be used to generate electricity without added fuel to produce it. Although we were not successful in amending the renewables bill to include this heat recovery, we believe this heat recovery could be counted and recoverable in SIP. In closing, I'd like to reiterate that SIP programs are an integral part of our customer service effort at Minnesota Power, and we feel it's part of our overall responsibility as an electricity provider to help our customers get value and satisfaction out of their energy use. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Thompson, I don't know if I missed it. Did you mention what the rate of conservation is at the Minnesota Power?
The spending requirements, as you know, is 1.5%, and that would have been $3.1 million of spending required by Minnesota Power. And in 2006, we spent $3.8 million.
Okay, but how about how much less energy was generated?
But the energy savings was 40 million kilowatt hours.
What percent?
Yeah, what percent?
Oh, of our total? I would say it's, I'll have to do the math, but I'd say it was about 1.2%.
Would you do the math on that for me, please?
Sure.
Okay.
And I caution you there, Senator, as well, from the standpoint that it depends on the economy. It depends on the technology that's used. As an example, we're currently still promoting CFLs. And once that market gets saturated, that all of us as consumers use CFLs, we need to continue to look at other technologies where we could provide those energy savings. So because we're potentially close to that goal, doesn't mean that we could produce that year after year after year. We'd need to continue to look at new technologies to encourage energy savings.
Okay. It would, and maybe this information is known or collected someplace, but it might be helpful to know what maybe of three or how long have we been doing SIP? A 3 or 5 year?
Four. 16, 17.
Long time. Yeah, since early 90s, right?
92, I believe.
So what the historical savings has been
on an
annual basis. Yeah. Okay. For all the utilities. Any questions or comments? Okay, we're going to hear from one more speaker today, and that's John Rolfe from Medtronic.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief, Madam Chair, members of the committee. End of the line, end of the customer, end of the agenda. My name is John Rolfe. I am currently the Global Energy Manager for Medtronic Incorporated, and I'm here to give you a perspective on the customer's view on how do you reward behavior for efficiency. A little bit, my background real quick. I came from Ford Motor Company, 21 years. I did just about everything you could at Ford, from working in the steam plants all the way up to the Global Energy Department at Ford. We're very, very concerned on the efficiency side at Ford. They were the Energy Star Partner of the Year last year. They saved probably tens of millions of dollars in energy through efficiency projects, of which I personally put in about $30 million worth of energy projects myself. I've done it in Canada, Mexico, U.S. I did the hydro plant here in St. Paul. I've done HVAC, AC, boilers, you name it, lighting. So I can say I know my business when it comes to efficiency and what really drives the efforts. In the, let's see here. One thing I'd like to make clear, there's a difference between conservation and efficiency. If you add a second shift to your plant, you're more efficient because your base load probably didn't change much, but you're making twice the product. So you need to have growth, and that's called efficiency. When you get into conservation, that's using less today than you did yesterday. And there are two different terms, and be careful about intermixing them. Another thing to be concerned about is there's a difference between the utility and the customer. I'm a little disappointed that I'm the only true customer here today. Don't forget, the SIP is my money that then gets put over here, shuffled around, and then given back to me. And so make sure you keep that in mind. Energy for big businesses, so to speak, or even the little blockbusters on the corner, energy is the same as labor. It's the same as materials and taxes. It's just another part of the cost of doing business. And every day you make a decision on where am I going to spend my capital. You typically want to put it in your core activities, R&D. New products drive Medtronic, I can tell you that. Two-thirds of our products didn't exist like 4 years ago. So we have to use capital to reinvest in R&D. We typically don't want to use our capital to replace a boiler that's still in good shape. So that's kind of where the mindset is on that. Rebates are always welcome. That's what we call them. We don't call them SIPs. It's a rebate program. They're welcome, but you know what? In the big picture, they're kind of small. They don't want to belittle it, but it probably helps us pay the sales tax on the project we did. So it's not big numbers when you're talking about boiler replacement. What really drives conservation is rates. 2 years ago, gas, $1.80 a gallon. Everybody's buying SUVs and trucks. And guess what happened? We wouldn't have driven customer buying habits through a SIP program for automobiles. It was $3.50 a gallon that did that. So rates is what drives conservation in industry. It's typically not a SIP program. It's also rates will also drive demand destruction. There's ask auto, ask steel, ask fertilizer companies. When natural gas tripled in price, they left. They're now in another part of the world. And so just because it looks like you're getting conservation, in reality, you might be having demand destruction, which meant, you know, the U.S. doesn't manufacture much anymore. Well, gee, we're looking so great on the efficiency side. Well, that's because we lost all the jobs. So don't forget about that as well. The best use of the efficiency money is upfront. You're buying your new house. Do I pay that little bit of extra up front to put in that high-efficiency furnace? If you have one now in your house that's working, you're not going to go on your own and replace a $2,000 furnace to save $150 a year. It's not good math. And if you get a little bit of a rebate program that gives you another, you know, a little bit off the top, it's still not – a 10-year payback is not something you're going to do. So the best use of that money is the upfront, not the after the fact, the horse left the barn. So my view is that the SIPs need to concentrate on educating the A&E firms, the make sure that the right stuff gets put in correctly the first time. After the fact, then it's too late. Use it for that better technology. The LEDs, boy, I'm waiting for that. We're going to replace all sorts of T8s, and I can't wait to replace them, even though they're brand new, because when the LEDs come, we'll be right there putting them in, because it's the technologies drive that sort of savings. When we do put in new equipment, the big things that we do are reliability, maintainability, safety, and efficiency. And it all comes into one big circle that we call life cycle cost. Because if you put in a really fancy variable frequency drive, because you're going to save a couple grand a year, and oops, the electronics crapped out on you. You just lost an hour and a half of production. You just lost your whole energy savings for about 5 years because that line was down for an hour and a half. So it has to be robust and reliable, or companies don't take the risk. It's not worth it. So hopefully that helps you see my point of view on efficiency and what drives companies. I'd be more than willing to talk to any one of you one-on-one about some of the things, you know, what I'm doing now at Medtronic globally and what I did in my past career at Ford and what we look for on the payback. You know, on the SIP, I mean, a good energy project is a two-year payback. So if we're spending 1.5%, that means we should be only getting about 0.7 something back. because there aren't many things out there that are a one-year payback. I wish there were. So that concludes my comments. Right now, any questions?
Mr. Rolfe, I would argue we're all customers.
That's true.
And also, you know, it's not energy efficiency or conservation just for the exercise of efficiency and conservation. It's seen in the larger picture of the global warming and what the cost effects are going to be if we continue to let this go on, and the cost that will come back to us that will be far higher than what we're trying to prevent are those higher costs by taking some smaller steps at this time.
Oh, I absolutely agree.
Any questions or comments? Thank you for taking the time to come and address us. That brings us, there are a couple of speakers that we didn't get to today. They will speak to us on Thursday, so there will be a little bit overlap on Thursday. I appreciate your taking a few extra moments today, but this brings us to the end of our meeting.